You're listening to KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. Stay tuned for Arab Voices next. Ahlan wa sahlan and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This program is being syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Today on the show, we will have two guests. Our first guest will be Dr. Asal Rad, research fellow at the National Iranian-American Council. We will speak with her about the U.S. assassination of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani in Iraq. We will talk about Iran's decision to reduce compliance with nuclear deal, the Iranian missile attacks on U.S. bases inside Iraq, the detentions of Iranian Americans at U.S. ports of entry, and more. During the second segment, our guest will be David Swanson, Executive Director of WorldBeyondWar.org and Campaign Coordinator for RootsAction.org. He is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. We will speak with him about the increased tension and attacks between the U.S. and Iran. We'll talk about U.S. military bases and forces in Iraq and other countries, especially in the Middle East, how to avert another war, and more. Before we begin the discussions with our guests, a quick announcement of upcoming events in the Houston area. The Arab American Educational Foundation is co-sponsoring a lecture by Dr. Irving Finkel of the British Museum about the Epic of Gilgamesh, the oldest epic in history. This will take place Thursday, January 9th at 6:30 p.m. at the Museum of Fine Arts, Houston. On January 11th, there will be a screening of the film Imprisoning a Generation. It is a 50-minute documentary film that follows the stories of four young Palestinians who have been detained and imprisoned in the Israeli military detention system and prosecuted in Israeli military courts. This event will be held at the Live Oak Friends Meeting Place on January 11th at 6 p.m. And on January 20th, there will be a screening of the film Gaza Fights for Freedom by Abby Martin. This movie shows life in Gaza, where over half the population are children and 70% are refugees. The film includes exclusive footage of the Great March of Return, at which peaceful protesters, only requesting to be able to return to their homes, have been shot by Israeli snipers. This event will be held at the Dominican Center for Spirituality on January 29th at 7 p.m. More information about these events and a list of many other events, visit our community calendar section online at arabvoices.net. So, as you know, tensions and attacks between the U.S. and Iran, all on Iraqi soil, have escalated dramatically over the past 7 days after the U.S. attacked and assassinated Iran's top commander, Qasem Soleimani, inside Iraq. Iran vowed to retaliate for this assassination, and it did so last night by firing missiles at U.S. military bases inside Iraq. And joining us now live via phone from California to talk about this is Dr. Asal Raad. She is a research fellow at the National Iranian American Council. She works with the policy team on research and writing related to Iran policy issues and the U.S.-Iran relations, and also works to organize Iranian Americans around issues that affect the community. Asal, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. It's great to have you again on the show.
Although, yes, thank you.
Absolutely. Although the world has been focusing on the last 7 days since the assassination of the top Iranian commander, Qasem Soleimani, this didn't start 7 days ago. The Iran and the U.S., they have been tensions, strangulations of the Iran's economy. So many things have taken place over so many years, especially under the Trump's administration. If you could just summarize the main points for us so we can put our listeners in perspective as we discuss the latest situations of the main points of what has taken place since the Trump administration and maybe even before that with the nuclear deal under the Obama administration.
Absolutely. So, you know, you said it yourself, there's a long history of, good relations and bad relations between these two countries. But really, regardless of the enmity that we've seen between Iran and the U.S. over the last 40 years, 5 years ago, in 2015, we had a nuclear deal in place. Iran and the United States were parties to the same deal, as were other members of the international community. And so despite all of that history, we were in a place with U.S.-Iran detente where Iran was prevented from being able to get a nuclear weapon. It's a model of security, not just for the United States, but global security, something that can be used. The JCPOA is a model, something that can be used for other cooperation on an international scale. And when the Trump administration came into power, what they inherited from the Obama administration was that deal. That was the really crowning success of President Obama's foreign policy. And though there were people within the Republican Party, especially, who were detractors from that deal, it provided what the international community was looking for at the time, and that was to make sure to contain Iran's nuclear program so that they could not get a weapon. Now, I say that, and Iran has repeatedly said that they don't want a weapon, that they've never pursued a weapon, but they were still sanctioned, and this is why we had to have this agreement, so that sanctions could be lifted, and the international community would have a way of monitoring and being assured that Iran is not actually trying to get a weapon. The Trump administration came into power. He quit the deal in, I believe it was May of 2018. And for the first year after quitting the deal, Iran complied to the letter of that agreement still, despite the fact that the U.S. put sanctions again, and despite the fact that they really bore none of the benefits that they were promised in the deal. So, a year later, having no benefits, waiting really for the European parties to the deal to somehow facilitate economic transactions and allow Iran to reap the benefits that it was promised, after not getting any of that, they started to incrementally reduce their commitments to the deal. And what we saw with you know, after, and we can get into the Soleimani assassination, but even after the Soleimani assassination, I'm still talking about the JCPOA. When Iran announced that it was its fifth announcement of reductions and basically saying it's not going to be limited by the deal anymore, that was not a reaction to the Soleimani assassination. That was something that was already planned, and Iran had taken these incremental steps over the last 7 or 8 months. And what's interesting is in the media, you started to hear people say, oh, Iran, you know, abandoned the deal. But Iran did not abandon the deal. In fact, the official Iranian statement said that the deal, the framework of the deal, would remain in place. And if sanctions were lifted, and if Iran was to finally receive the benefits that were enshrined in the deal, then it would return to full commitment. So the deal, while a lot of Iran hawks and people who have tried to move us more and more towards conflict will say the deal is dead, the deal does exist. The framework of the deal exists. And so there is a way of reversing those steps, and there is a way of going back to it. In terms of the tension, that's the context of the tension we've seen over the last week. But of course, this action by this administration to assassinate a top general of a sovereign nation has potentially changed the whole game in terms of the ability to go back to any kind of negotiation.
Let me ask you on that deal again, because during the Trump administration, even before he was elected president, he has talked frequently about that was that a disastrous deal and it must end or it must be revised. Did the Trump administration ever made a case to what is it that it wanted to change it to? Because like you mentioned, we have Europe, the United Nations inspectors, everybody said that Iran all along has and was fully compliant with the terms of that nuclear deal, and everything was perfect, stable, and working as they agreed upon. What is it that the Trump wanted to change?
Well, as you saw in the reaction of the administration, Secretary of State Pompeo came out with his list of 12 preconditions. And if you look at the preconditions, those have really nothing to do with their nuclear program. So what the Trump administration did is it conflated other issues that the United States and other states may have with Iran and Iran's activities within the region, and they conflated that with the nuclear deal. Whereas the nuclear deal was meant, and this is why it was advocated by non-proliferation groups so strongly, it was meant to curb any ability for Iran to get a weapon. That Iran is a signatory to the NPT. As being a signatory, you are allowed to have a nuclear energy program. But being a signatory means you believe in non-proliferation, not having weapons. So, you know, we can get into the sort of what did the Trump administration want. What it seemed like is that they didn't want the nuclear deal. They wanted to have Iran submit to a series of demands that really no sovereign state would submit to. And this is where the sort of stalemate has been for such a long time. What's interesting is the Trump administration has now moved beyond those 12 preconditions, because I think there's a rationality of understanding that that was never going to be a plausible demand. And now you've heard them multiple times say, you know, we can negotiate with no preconditions. So, you know, it's hard to tell where this administration is going with their policy. The policy has lacked coherence from the very beginning. Are we to take the president at his word when he says he doesn't want a war, when he says all he wants, I mean, he's explicitly stated that he doesn't want regime change. He has explicitly said that all he wants is for Iran to not have a nuclear weapon. The irony of that being is that's precisely what the deal guaranteed.
And he slapped severe sanctions on Iran also.
Yes. And, you know, the sanctions have just gotten worse and worse over time, because really that's the only tool we seem to be using. You know, the sanctions are a tool, but the way they're being used currently is it really renders them pointless. What can be sanctioned further? That was interesting about the announcement that the president made today. On one hand, I would like to say it was a relief that the rhetoric, despite the fact that it was still, you know, it still had the same sort of aggressive, threatening style, it was there was a clear indication that this wasn't about more further military conflict, that he was not looking for further military escalation. And I think that we should all be happy about that. But again, sanctions, that was the next weapon, that we're going to put more sanctions. And sanctions have, you know, there's the issue of humanitarian goods. Sanctions have prevented certain specialized medicines, especially because Iran, in Iran, they actually produce that over 90% of their own medicines. But there are certain specialized medicines that they don't produce. And for instance, medicines for cancer. And so those things are, they're not able to make those purchases. And so Iranians are suffering. Beyond that, just broadly speaking, the economy has been so affected by the sanctions that if you're, you know, middle class, you're already feeling your wallet tighten very, very much. And then if you were poor, if you were lower class to begin with, you know, this is why we saw protests a month and a half ago in mid-November when we saw the reaction to a hike in gas prices. Because really what the people were saying is they can't, it was too much. They couldn't afford it anymore. So it is having an effect on their economy, on their livelihoods. And, you know, it seems like a collective punishment tool intended to, you know, force that population to sort of put pressure on their own government in desperation.
And we know the oil export, that has a major factor with what the Trump administration did, because Iran used to export some, I think, 2-point-something million barrels a day, and now only a few hundred thousand, and that accounts for 70%. The oil export accounted for 70% of the Iranian government's revenue, so that has a major impact. So take us to what led to and why did the United States assassinated the Iranian general on Iraqi soil? Not that it matters where they assassinated him. Why did it go after the commander, the top commander in Iran?
Well, it would certainly be a very difficult blow for Iran. So strategically, maybe the Trump administration, President Trump, actually, I should say, because in this case, according to the president himself and the Department of Defense, this was a directive straight from him. This was a choice that he made. You know, attacking a top official, especially a military man, especially someone with the stature of Soleimani, is a very, very difficult blow for the Iranian state to take. But it really stems from these conflicts that were like, why does it happen in Iraq? Because it stems from these conflicts that are happening in Iraq where they're now using Iraq, and this can't be emphasized enough, Iraq is a sovereign state, and both the Iranians and the Americans cannot, or should not, I should say, because they do, be using it as a theater for their own conflict. After U.S. rocket attacks that killed Iraqis, I believe it was 20 or 25 Iraqis, there was an attack on the U.S. embassy, and the U.S. embassy looked at this, and the U.S. looked at this as an entirely Iranian operation. Which is interesting because if you look a month before that, when the Iranian embassy was being set fire to in Najaf, there wasn't that kind of reaction of, well, this is sovereign soil and this is, you know, at that point, it was a very clear indication of Iraqi sovereignty and, you know, the Iraqis want the Iranians out. They don't want any more influence on their politics. But then when it's reversed and it's the United States, we get a very different narrative, which is, oh, this is not, these aren't Iraqi people. This is all Iranian-backed and sort of undermining the agency of Iraqis, who have every right to say that they don't want any foreign power using their country as, you know, in a sort of proxy war that they're fighting each other.
So there are a lot of reports out there that this top commander, Soleimani, there was one thing, quote-unquote, in common with the United States that they had, which was fighting ISIS, although the U.S. to fight ISIS is a big, huge question, because there are some there who think that the U.S. was actually funding ISIS, whether directly or indirectly, to wreak havoc in Syria and in Iraq. But regardless, so if the U.S. says to the world, we are fighting ISIS, and Soleimani, according to reports, he was a major a factor in fighting ISIS in Iraq, why would they assassinate him at this time?
You know, for one thing, ISIS's position is quite weakened at this point, right? So if this were to happen a few years ago, it may have been a game changer in how to, and not to say that this won't affect it at all, but of course, looking at Soleimani might be a very important and large figure, but the IRGC is a very large organization. You know, there are capable people to take his place, maybe not in terms of the public figure that he was, but in terms of their ability to, you know, tactically continue what he was doing. The fight against ISIS, we seem to be moving towards the winning side at this point, so it seems like less of a risk in terms of that. But also because, you know, it's hard to tell with this president. He had a tweet that said that he would attack cultural sites, and he specified the number 52. And it went back to the hostage crisis in 1979, which to me, you could see that as soon as the U.S. embassy in Baghdad was under attack, there was a sort of, you know, that was the reaction that you were seeing. And it seemed much like what you saw now on the Iranian side. It seems like there's those sort of national prides that are being undermined. And so they feel the need to really, you know, it seems like tit for tat, they're just going at it back and forth. I would argue that strategically for the United States, this was a terrible decision, because really what it did, if we had protests in Iran a month and a half ago where Iranians were protesting their own government, now this action has galvanized that population behind their own government.
Yeah, and since that assassination, Iran, of course, went to immediately vowed to revenge, vowed to severely attack and punish the United States for what it did. And it did so last night by launching some over 20 ballistic missiles precisely pointing at U.S. bases. They are actually Iraqi military bases, but hey, I mean, to me, they are U.S. bases that has been occupying and wreaking havoc inside Iraq anyway. So they launched them at those U.S. military bases inside Iraq. Some say intentionally not to harm U.S. soldiers. They pinpointed where every hit will actually land. And what we know so far, no casualties, nobody was injured, nobody was killed. Your reaction to the Iranian launch and attack on the bases inside Iraq?
You know, the rhetoric they're going to use, the way they talk about it, will be to, you know, display the sort of exactly how you presented it, this avenging the death of the assassination, or what they will say is the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani. But they have shown, by they I mean the Iranian government has shown, throughout this administration, with everything, with the sanctions, with the JCPOA, that every step they've taken is very carefully measured. You know, so we're now more than a year and a half into when the president quit the deal and implemented sanctions. And Iran, like I said, the first year, they didn't react at all. You know, it was a strategy of patience. And after the strategy of patience, the strategic move was to say, okay, well, after a year, we're not getting anything out of this, but we have to change tactics. But it wasn't to become reactionary. It was, again, very carefully measured actions and intentionally not creating any kind of casualties. Because, of course, once there are casualties, it changes the nature of the conflict. So, to me, it would seem like this was another carefully thought-out move to both, you know, show on the national side to avenge what the people wanted, which is to take some revenge upon what the Americans have done, but at the same time, to do it in a way where President Trump could react how he did today, right? So this was the opportunity, and I really, really hope it stays the opportunity for this cycle of violence to end at least. And then at that point, maybe we can push back into negotiations. And that is precisely what the president alluded to today. So it seems as though that was an intentional move on the Iranian part.
And, you know, to be honest, my personal, I'll say my personal view on it. When of course, all TVs and radios across the world, it was live coverage. It was like the end of the world or World War III about to start or a catastrophe and so on and so on. And actually, if a war started, it would have been catastrophic on all sides. But after or during the attack and when it ended, apparently, and a few hours later when Trump tweeted, and knowing Trump, if there was something bad to happen, his tweet last night would have been more severe, would not have been all is good. So I figured out, I think the U.S. may already know that they are about to hit and there will be no casualties and let it go. This is their revenge and we're even. Nobody wants war. Nobody can afford this war and this will be the end of it. So
that, his tweet was the tweets that he had earlier in the week before the attacks, this is an interesting way of looking at it. The tweets he had before Iran attacked were much more aggressive than the tweet after. So, you would think that gave a sense of relief. But of course, I think people were still anticipating what the announcement was going to be in the morning. I think the biggest issue in dealing with this particular president is the decisions sometimes seem erratic, where one day he speaks very aggressively about an adversary, whether it be Iran, whether it be North Korea, and then, can sort of turn around the next day and be very friendly with the exact same adversary. So it's hard to predict because there doesn't, and this is indicative of his general foreign policy, there's no coherence to it. There's no, it's not bound to, it doesn't seem bound to any ideological point of view besides getting a win. So at this point, it seems, we're in an election year in the United States, and I think that's something important to consider as well. We're in an election year, and President Trump has not really had a specific foreign policy success besides assassinating people, besides killing, right? So there's no success in terms of actually getting better at nuclear nonproliferation or getting deals done. And this is someone who, the art of the deal. This is the president. This is the person. He embodies that concept. So going into an election, I think he's looking for some kind of win. And maybe now they're, for lack of a better phrase, they're even. But we'll just have to see where it goes. The thing that is important to keep in mind in these situations is most often from a historical perspective, when conflicts arise, oftentimes they're not intentional. There's just one miscalculation. There's a miscalculation on one end, and then you're in a conflict, and then getting out of the conflict is much more difficult. So it would be prudent for both parties to deal with these situations with a lot more caution.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you a question, Asal. Your organization, specifically the National Iranian American Council, has been monitoring and reporting on what seems to be detention of Iranians coming back to the United States over the past week since the assassination of Soleimani at different ports of entry to the United States. What could you share with us about that?
So the largest incident was there was a concert in Vancouver, and I believe it was on Sunday. There was a concert in Vancouver and an Iranian concert. And so a lot of people from Washington went to the concert. And then when they were coming back, about 60 people were detained for further questioning. And they were held anywhere from 10 to 16 hours, which, is not an overnight detention, but clearly for, and these are American citizens, green card holders. So that level of scrutiny for an American citizen is what really raised the red flag. And the other issue was that that was not the only place where we heard such reports. I think that was the largest and strictest sort of reaction that you saw from Border Patrol. But there was also a story from JFK. There was at least one report from JFK where, in fact, it's John Kazmian. He's an author that's coming out with a book about Iran-U.S. relations, ironically. And he reported being questioned at JFK, but the nature of the questions are problematic as well. So if you're being asked things like, what is your opinion of the current situation or what is your opinion of Soleimani, that's not really an immigration, like, that's not a question you ask someone, an average American. And so what's discriminatory about it is obviously being of Iranian heritage, you're being profiled and asked these questions. And because of the precedent that we have in this country, now, it was a long time ago, you could say, but, you know, and I don't want to exaggerate the situation or compare it in any way to Japanese internment, because they're not even in the same, you know, realm. But there's a fear that exists among the community, and that's problematic. It's not okay for Americans of any heritage or any descent to suddenly feel like their loyalties to the country is being questioned. And it's the rhetoric that's similar, and that's the part that scares people. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, we are certainly not the only or first minority in this country who has felt this kind of vulnerability or insecurity under this administration. So there's a larger issue.
And we are going to leave it at this with you, Dr. Asarat. But before we go, if you could give the website for your organization to our listeners, because I know you all publish notes and information that is useful on the current situation.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. It's niacouncil.org. So niacouncil.org.
And we have a link to that on our website, arabvoices.net. Dr. Asarat, research fellow at the National Iranian American Council, has been joining us from California. Thank you so much. We greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. We will take a break now, and when we come back, we will speak live with David Swanson, Executive Director of WorldBeyondWar.org and Campaign Coordinator for RootsAction.org, who is also author, activist, journalist, and radio host. We will continue the conversation with him about the increased tension between the United States and Iran and the recent attacks on both sides. We will talk about U.S. military bases and forces in Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries and beyond, how to avert another war in the Middle East, and more. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Joining us now live via phone from Virginia is David Swanson. David is the executive director of WorldBeyondWar.org and campaign coordinator for RootsAction.org. He is an author, activist, journalist, and radio host. He was awarded the 2018 Peace Prize by the U.S. Peace Memorial Foundation, David Swanson recently drafted a resolution urging Congress to move money from the military to human and environmental needs rather than the reverse. Versions of the resolution were passed by several cities and by the U.S. Conference of Mayors. David, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. It's good to have you again on the show. I'd like to start with your reaction to the latest tension, not the first, but the latest escalation of tension and attacks started with the U.S. assassination of the top Iranian commander inside Iraq.
Yeah, well, it is new and it is different and it is particularly Trumpian, and there are real concerns about the way in which Trump does things, but I think the important story, as you note, is that this is not the first. This has been building for decades. There have been people in Washington, D.C. who have wanted to overthrow the Iranian government since 1979. The son of the Shah has spent much of those years in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., sometimes reportedly with pay from the CIA, waiting his turn. There are leaders of both parties, Senator Chuck Schumer of the Democrats and his counterpart among the Republicans, who have wanted to overthrow the government of Iran for many, many years. And in the lead up to this problem, you had senators and Congress members of both parties denouncing Trump for being weak and demanding that Trump be stronger on Iran, in particular following the crowds in Iraq storming the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad. And you had Congress refuse to impeach Trump or try him for any crimes related to wars or even threatening nuclear war on Iran as well as North Korea or any related outrages, preferring some obscure scandal tied to Ukraine, and giving Trump more military spending even than he asked for, possibly across all departments, more than the United States has ever spent, and stripping out of that bill numerous dozens of important measures that the House had included that the Senate didn't, and calling that a compromise, and one of them was banning a war on Iran. So Congress took that out of a bill. It's worth noting that under the U.S. Constitution, the president doesn't get to start any wars. And under the UN Charter, nobody gets to start any wars, and yet Congress declined to redundantly ban President Trump from starting a war on Iran. So this is, and of course, the corporate media in the United States has been just awful at inciting war fever. So it's something that's been building for a long time. There are a lot of people to blame, but there are some encouraging steps on the horizon, and it's possible that that we will avoid a major war on Iran yet again.
You know, but it's interesting you talked about the Democrats and so on. Regardless of their dispute with Trump on other issues, when it comes to the U.S. foreign policy, so we're talking about Iran now and Iraq and so on, they weren't against Trump's assassination of another country's top commander. They were disputing, some of them, how come we didn't know in advance, or why did you do it here or not there, or why now? But it wasn't about, it's okay, go ahead, murder, kill somebody's else top commander in another country's sovereign. It's just, they're all, when it comes to wars and against the Middle East, they are all together.
That's absolutely right and critically important. You know, when it comes to that 60% of funding that Congress decides what to do with every year that goes to militarism, that goes to the Pentagon and the nuclear weapons and the so-called Homeland Security and all the secret agencies and spy agencies, there's perfect harmony in Washington, D.C. There's no gridlock. There's no animosity. There's just full steam ahead, more money than ever. And the concerns you hear are primarily, disproportionately, and of course disproportionately represented in the corporate media, sort of, he should have done this the way Obama would have done it. He shouldn't have tweeted it. He should have informed a handful of Congress members first. He shouldn't have tweeted a flag. He shouldn't have said he would attack cultural sites. That's a war crime. You should just slaughter thousands of human beings. That's appropriate, but you shouldn't, you know, destroy an old church. That would be offensive. And so it's, yeah, there's this acceptance of war that's been the norm in Washington, D.C. for many years, and there's this normalization of individual murders that really took place during the Obama years, and that I very foolishly had these hopes people would turn against once Trump's face was on the murder weapon rather than Obama's, and I was absolutely wrong. Trump took over the drone murder program and escalated it, and nobody cared because Obama had so effectively made it normal and acceptable.
So the United States, and I don't really know how much our listeners know this, there are hundreds of military bases for the United States throughout the Middle East, Europe, and so many other countries that is costing the United States, you mentioned, trillions of dollars. And we are wreaking havoc throughout the world, especially in the Middle East, devastating war on Iraq, that started so many years ago, destroyed the country, the infrastructure that up to now it is suffering, and for so many more years to come. We have military bases in Iraq. We have the largest embassy in the world. I'm going to throw a number and people may not believe me. That largest embassy in the world for the U.S. in Iraq has what, 14 to 15,000 employees working in it. What are they doing? Governing the whole Middle East from there? But tell us more about this militarization, this military bases that the U.S. has all over.
Remember also that we've been told over the years that wars were ended. It's curious to me what people who imagine that Barack Obama ended the U.S. war in Iraq and brought the troops out make of the current demand by the Iraqi government for the troops to get out. How do people manipulate that in their minds? I don't know. But the green zone, the embassy, the city within a city, this place that's bigger than the Vatican in Rome, but it's the United States in Baghdad, it's called an embassy, but it's a means of staying while pretending to leave. And, of course, there are U.S. troops in all these other bases, including the two that were recently attacked by missiles from Iran, and there are nearly 1,000 major U.S. bases in over 80 countries spread around the globe, most of them the most vicious dictatorships on Earth. The U.S. Fifth Fleet is in Bahrain, the U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia, in Kuwait, I mean, all around the Middle East, in fact, encircling Iran. The problem with Iran, as with the other countries that you hear about in U.S. news reports as evil dictatorships and rogue nations and so forth, are that they're on that short list of countries that don't have any U.S. bases, don't have any U.S. troops yet. And so this is why you have the demonization of Iran in U.S. media. It's not because Iran is particularly a worse country for its people or for the world than numerous other countries, although we all know it has major flaws. But the propaganda has not worked well. You know, I think in part because people in the United States have learned from the past, from these recent wars, all being disasters, and in part I think because so much effort went into demonizing former Iranian President Ahmadinejad as the evil dictator, and then he got unelected, which is a weird thing to have happen to, you know, the world's evil dictator, to be voted out by a voting public. There isn't the demand in the U.S. public for war that there was in 01 or 03. There isn't the demand against it that there was either, but there is significant opposition to it. And there's more opposition to it in Congress than there was. I mean, 2001, there was one congresswoman who would oppose war on Afghanistan, and she had to have bodyguards to protect her. Now you've got numerous Congress members and senators demanding an immediate vote to block a war on Iran. I mean, that's at least marginal progress.
How do you think that will go?
Well, Nancy Pelosi is trying to delay it while at the same time announcing that the world can't survive another one of these wars. So I don't know how to make sense of that or most things that come out of her mouth. But I think that there will have to be a vote within the next week or week and a half in both houses. And I can't predict, and I wouldn't, you know, bet serious money if I had any on passage. And of course, these will need to be passed with veto-proof majorities. But I think it's at least encouraging that there will be a vote. These people will have to be on record one way or the other, Congress members and senators. If you go to a place I work, rootsaction.org, you can click one button and email your representative and your two senators and demand that they vote the right way. And then follow up and find out. I mean, we'll have to make sure they understand that we're going to hold everyone accountable to every extent we can if they vote the wrong way. We're going to try to vote them out of office.
Now, Trump, during the elections before he became president, he promised to end the wars. Well, he promised so many things, and he did not deliver on many things. But now, while he's in office, he talks about wars. We will obliterate countries. We will put sanctions like never before. His rhetoric is just unbelievable. He would make the deal of the century for the Palestinians and the Israelis, and it is far, far. It's actually completely the opposite. And it's not just really Trump. If you look at the history, most of presidents, so when it comes to foreign policy, and especially towards the Middle East, who really rules and decides? Because what happens in office is completely different than what those people say before they become presidents.
Well, it is completely different, and it's not completely different, because they say contradictory things. I mean, you can remember Barack Obama saying, "I'll end the war, I'll end the war." You know, meaning Iraq. He was promising to escalate in Afghanistan and end the war in Iraq. But then he would tell reporters, and it would be reported in the New York Times, he doesn't really mean end the war in Iraq. He means kind of scale it down a little bit and so forth. Well, Trump was worse than that. Trump promised no more wars. I'm against these regime change wars. We got these stupidest wars ever. We got to bring the troops home. I'll bring every troop home from Afghanistan right away. And at the same time, what we need to do is kill their families, not just kill them, but kill their families. We need to steal their oil. This is the problem with the wars. The wars are fine, but you have to steal their oil. You know, and so what I was telling people about Trump then, and have been saying thousands and thousands of times ever since, is the thing to do, the thing to look at, is not what nonsense is coming out of their mouths, but what they're saying about the military budget. And every one of these people, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Donald Trump, have campaigned on, we need a larger military budget. Now, you've got somebody like Senator Bernie Sanders campaigning on, we need a smaller military budget, and we need that money for human needs and environmental needs. That's the key difference to look at, because you cannot invest in war and prevent war at the same time. You cannot put all of this money into all of these weapons and programs, and the weapons have to be tested and they have to be used so you can buy new ones, and you got all these planners figuring out schemes to start wars. You can't do that and not have wars. There's this bizarre notion that still lingers in the minds of some Americans that more military spending means fewer wars, where the exact opposite has been, you know, consistently established for the past 7,500 years. So that's what I think we had to look at with Donald Trump, and still do, is that he wanted more military spending. Now, as we just said, Congress gives him even more than he asks for. So it's not a single individual that's the problem here. But, you know, that's what I expected from Donald Trump, and that's what we've gotten.
And what do you think of the military-industrial complex, and how much influence does that have on the creation of wars or more militarization and so on, so they can benefit so many people and companies, this military-industrial complex out there?
It's, you know, Eisenhower didn't act against it, but he spoke against it in part of one speech very accurately. And it does infiltrate our entire society, our entire culture. I mean, here in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I live, the city council is very responsive. They've already just passed a resolution opposing war in Iran. We recently had them pass a measure to divest all public money from weapons and fossil fuels, and I heard that people in Arlington, Virginia, were interested in that, and I went and spoke. I spoke with a county board member there. Can Arlington divest public money from weapons? Oh, no, he said. I mean, totally openly, totally shamelessly. Oh, no, Boeing built us a park. Boeing has money in our county, and we have a national cemetery of war dead here. And I said, well, does that mean you want more bodies in it? I don't understand that. And so this influence, it's not just the bribes. It's not just the legalized bribery, the Congress members whose votes you can predict based on how much money they're getting for their campaigns and so-called contributions. It's who's allowed in the media and how you're allowed to think and be respectable in our culture. I mean, you now have members of the military and retired members of the military and active and retired CIA and other secret agency officials as paid permanent spokespeople on the media, working for CNN and MSNBC and so forth, with absolutely no shame and no warning that these are people making money from weapons. Who are inviting on guests to interview who are also making money from weapons. I mean, this is so you have Congress members say, oh, I hope that Trump doesn't retaliate if Iran retaliates, but it would be crazy not to. What do you mean it would be crazy not to? It would be crazy not to destroy the world? This is the kind of thinking bought and paid for by weapons makers.
Yeah, and for many, many years, many have said that the U.S. is there because of the oil, because the Middle East is rich in oil. Iraq has the second largest oil reserve in the world, and other countries there have oil. Just curious, today Trump, in his remark earlier this morning, he mentioned that we no longer depend on oil from the Middle East. We don't care. We don't need it. We have enough oil here, basically. And then we know the Iraqi government voted the parliament to expel U.S. troops from Iraq. Do you think there are other reasons for the U.S. to stay in the Middle East? We know it is wreaking havoc even in countries that doesn't have oil. Or will that have any effect on the U.S. presence in the Middle East?
I think that wars and warlike actions and sanctions and occupations happen for numerous reasons that combine to outweigh the numerous reasons against. And in this case, they include irrational power drives. They include the military bureaucracy. They include the weapons profiteering. And they absolutely, as a top priority, include the oil. And Trump is lying when he pretends not to care about the oil. If he's not lying, the prime minister of Iraq is lying, who says that Trump spoke with him on the phone and said, you have to give us 50% of your oil or we're not going to rebuild anything. And when the prime minister of Iraq went to China and got deals from China to do infrastructure in Iraq, Trump threatened to mobilize crowds to try to overthrow him and to have Marines shoot members of the demonstrators, and in fact, apparently did do those things and further threatened to murder the Iraqi prime minister. And this is all about the oil. Meanwhile, you have a Congress obsessed with a phone call with the president of Ukraine. Explain that to me.
Yeah. Now, I want to ask you this question, get your thoughts on it, because we know Israel, for so many years, has been trying to push the United States into war with Iran. Do you think this latest development has anything to do with that, and or some say this is another thing on behalf of Israel that the United States was trying to get into with Iran. What's your take on that?
Again, I always think, because it always seems very clear to be the case, that there are many factors. So I don't know that we can find the one secret motivation. But I think Israel has been a big factor here, and Saudi Arabia has been a factor here. And that when you learn, again, from the Iraqi prime minister, if it turns out to be accurate, that General Soleimani was on essentially a diplomatic mission between Iran and Saudi Arabia, with Iraq acting as peacemaker, this is not something Israel wants. And if you look at the role that Israel played in the lead-up to this crisis, Israel is being deceptive when they pretend not to have been part of this. There's a former Washington Post reporter named Jefferson Morley who's been writing about the influence of Israel on these developments. There is no question. And of course, Israel is a big factor from the other side, or the speeches you're hearing out of Iran and Lebanon and elsewhere, saying that the United States, not just the United States, but Israel and the Israeli government need to be kicked out of the Middle East as a result of this murder in Baghdad.
So we only have about a minute or so left for the show. David, if you could share with our listeners, you mentioned it briefly earlier, what can people do? And I know you have organizations and websites and resources for people to know. There were demonstrations in Houston, at least two over the weekend. I think there are many more planned for asking for no war with Iran. But what can people do to avert wars?
Well, one place I can refer people to is rootsaction.org, because you can click one button and email your representative and senators to act immediately. Two congresswomen, Ilhan Omar and Barbara Lee, and one senator, Tim Kaine, have put in these resolutions that are privileged, that force a vote within the next several days. Another place I work that you can go to is worldbeyondwar.org. Where you can find all kinds of resources and information, educational and activist, to move our culture and our politics in the right direction. And you can find a calendar and a map of events. There are peace organizations planning events in the coming days, and a big international day of action against war on Iran on the 25th of January. But all sorts of things happening, even just in the days between now and the 25th.
Very well. And I already have links to those websites that you mentioned on our website, arabvoices.net. The only time I have left is to thank our guest, David Swanson, Executive Director of worldbeyondwar.org and Campaign Coordinator for rootsaction.org. David, thank you so much. We greatly appreciate your time this evening.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.